Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Unforgiving 60. I'm joined by my co-host, Tim.
Hi, Ben.
G'day. Now, by the time I finish this introduction, Australian police will have responded to another case of domestic violence. Every 2 minutes, Australian police are dealing with a DV issue. These sort of statistics blew me away. I had no idea the problem was as widespread or as prevalent. And indeed, KPMG have estimated that it costs the Australian population about $22 billion each year. Our next guest is someone who is not only very familiar with the domestic violence statistics in this country, but has dedicated her life to trying to help the victims of domestic violence. We are extremely pleased to be joined today by the CEO of Starrick, Leanne Barron. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Tim.
G'day, Ben.
And Tim and I are both joined by our very special guest today, Leanne Barron, who's the CEO of Starrick. Leanne, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. Maybe we could start by providing a bit of your background and how you got to where you are today, Leanne.
Okay, well, I guess I grew up in a family where social justice was very important. My dad was a trade unionist. We're a Catholic family. The school I went to, social justice was taken seriously. So the roots go way back to those days. And at the age of 16, I decided I wanted to be a social worker for that reason. So after school, I did social work at Curtin, and really it's kind of gone from there. That has been my career most of that time. So I've worked in government services, and I've worked for government as well, but always the theme around trying to make a difference in the community at whatever level.
And Starrick now?
Yeah, so I joined Starrick just over 5 years ago, came out of government, so I think I'd kind of got to the end of my time there and felt like I wanted to make more of a difference on the ground where I could see the effects of what I was doing a bit more. So went in there, and I guess I had some particular passions at that time. Some came out of my government work around early childhood, so I felt like I really wanted to make a contribution for children who'd experienced domestic violence, see if we could strengthen our service delivery there. And of course, you know, we've had such terrible statistics around domestic violence, so really wanting to make a contribution to supporting women, strengthening women, that kind of thing.
And can you tell us a bit about Starrick, what it does and how it's structured?
Yeah, sure. So we really started as a standalone refuge about 30 years ago, and then since that time we've grown. I'd like to think we offer quite an integrated range of services. So we have two refuges for women and children fleeing violence. So that is where the level of risk is really high and they can't stay in their home. So they have to come somewhere safe and kind of go from there. And then we have a transitional housing program for women after they've left the refuge. So that's when the level of risk is less. They're ready to go back out into the community and re-establish themselves. We still provide a level of support, but it's about helping them resettle back into the community, their kids back into schools, childcare, link with local services, that kind of thing. We have two staff based in police stations. So they see clients after police have attended an incident, or women might attend the police station to report something. So that's a really good service, because even if people don't know about a domestic violence service, they know to go to the police for help. Yeah. So it's like a common kind of entry place. And then we run Safe at Home for women. So that's where there's been domestic violence and then the perpetrator's no longer in the house, and it's safe for the woman to stay there. So we would put in some physical upgrades to the property like window locks, change keys. Mm-hmm. We might put in security cameras if we think there's high risk, like that the perpetrator might be coming back to the house or present a risk in some way. And we help her with her ongoing safety and safety planning.
Yeah.
And then the last bit is a counselling service. Yeah. So that's only 2 days a week, which is because of limits on funding. And I guess the other thing I should say, within the refuges, we run a children's program because the refuges accommodate women and children, and we can have up to 19 children staying in each refuge mm-hmm. at any one time. So we have school holiday programs. We run an annual camp for families. We provide groups, a bit of, you know, children's yoga, meditation, you know, those kind of things, some parenting programs. So we think we've got a pretty broad mix of yeah. services. And then on top of that, just as I suppose venturing more into prevention, we're working with White Ribbon on the rollout of respectful relationships in WA schools. So because they're a national body, we're supporting the implementation on the ground. And then we've just started a project with local businesses in the Southeast Corridor, small to medium businesses who might not be able to go for big things like White Ribbon accreditation. So we're just going to be meeting with them to talk about what supports might they need if they think their employees are using or experiencing violence. So, you know, I guess we've really, you know, we're trying to be responsive. We try to grow and deal with the whole range of situations that women face.
Yeah, and you used that word integrated before, which it sounds exactly like what you're living. These are very complementary services.
Yeah, and I think, you know, women's experience of domestic violence is very individual, so you need a service mix so that you can respond to all the different things they face.
I want to talk in much more detail about the services you do, but maybe before we start, can you tell us a bit about Henrietta Starick? I read a bit online about her pioneering work in this field. Quite an amazing lady.
Yeah, so we're named for her, and I guess the reason Starick House first came about through the work of City of Armidale, City of Gosnells, and some local Labor Party politicians, Kay Hallahan and Yvonne Henderson, who some listeners might be aware of. Mm. And I guess it was very much based around the Gosnells Armidale area, and because she was such a strong personality there, that the decision was made to name the service for her. So she was a midwife. She delivered, you know, hundreds of babies in the area. She experienced domestic violence herself. And I think she had 7 children. I'm thinking that's right.
12.
12 children.
Reading. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, when things got bad at home, she'd pile everyone in the boat and they'd row down the river to get away. And, you know, I guess that reflects that in those days, there was nowhere for women to go. So often people would escape for a while, but they'd always have to go back home.
And this is in the interwar years we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
So, we mentioned some of the statistics in our introduction, but one that completely blew me away when I was researching for this discussion was the White Ribbon statistic that says intimate partner violence is a leading contributor to illness, disability and premature death for women aged 18 to 44 and is the greatest health risk factor to women aged 25 to 44.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, I guess we tend to hear about the deaths, I would argue not as much as we should do, but we don't think about the other consequences that are around health-related issues or, you know, injuries that don't result in death. To us, it's not a surprise. I mean, sometimes when women come in, I think it's amazing that their injuries aren't worse when I think about what they've experienced. And sometimes I think I'm surprised that more women haven't died when I've seen the injuries they've come into our services with. And I guess there are some things that are long-term kind of consequences, slightly hidden. Mm-hmm. So we've just recently done training on non-fatal strangulation, and that's where, you know, the airwaves are blocked until women lose consciousness. And now studies are showing that the consequences of that can be long-term in terms of brain injury. So they might be things that aren't necessarily picked up as part of the DV picture, but that's, you know, that's what the cause of them is so, it is a shocking statistic, but it's not surprising when we think about our work.
And domestic violence does affect men, but the statistics are quite insignificant?
They're relatively low, so most violence is perpetrated against women, and then the majority of violence against men is perpetrated by other men, so that might be in a same-sex relationship, or it might be violence within families.
And Leanne, this is fundamentally a people-to-people problem, and it sounds like it's a people-to-people solution. What does your workforce look like? What are their backgrounds and what do they do?
We've got quite a varied workforce, quite a few different cultural backgrounds. So I think within our service, within our refuges, about 50% of the clients are Aboriginal women, about 30% are culturally and linguistically diverse women. And to some extent, our workforce reflects that, probably not quite as much as it should. Most people have either social work or community work or those kind of backgrounds. Some of them have had experience of domestic violence themselves, probably maybe around 25%. It's a varied workforce.
Amazing cultural diversity. How hard do you have to work to understand the cultural nuances associated with domestic violence?
Yeah, that's probably, for me, works on two levels. So in one way, it is that violence is unacceptable. But I guess we work with women who've come from environments where it is accepted within that culture or parts of the culture. Having said that, they're not accepting anymore because they're, moving away from it and escaping it. So I guess we're seeing kind of changes as new migrant groups, live in Australia, stay in Australia, then they're starting to see that violence isn't acceptable, but also understand that there's a service system out there that can support them.
That can help. I imagine there is an intergenerational thing here, regardless of cultural background, that there is a perpetuation of violence through generations.
Yeah.
It sounds like a silly question. What can we do? What is society doing to try and break those cycles?
I think in a way we're probably not doing enough.
Okay.
I would say it's not 100% causal. You know, if you grow up in a family in domestic violence, in a household where that happens, you won't necessarily go on to become a victim or a perpetrator. There's other factors at work. But I think, you know, we do see families where violence is sort of normalised and it's very entrenched. I think a lot more has to happen for children who grow up in those families. I don't think the response to those kids is really strong enough. Even for us as a service, we see that we're not doing as much as we could, primarily because of lack of funds.
Yeah.
And I think also, so there's those families, but then there's the attitudes around in the community that support those families in some way, you know, just cultures of disrespect or those sort of things. I think work in schools is really important, doing the respectful relationships work, and just making school communities more respectful in general. I think that's a starting point. I don't feel like I have the whole answer, but I do think probably some kids, some families need very intensive work. The level of violence is so severe that, you know, children are experiencing trauma. Mm. And I think we need to take more seriously that growing up in a violent home is a traumatic experience for kids that then has flow-on effects, which we know about trauma in general. You know, it affects brain functioning. That means it can impact on their social and emotional development. And then in more practical ways, it impacts on schooling. So they might not be turning up to school because it's chaos at home, or their brains are overloaded with what they're experiencing. So when they get to school, they can't concentrate, you know, just all that range of factors.
Is there any research, either scientific or anecdotal, on a link between bullying and domestic violence?
Not that I've seen. That's an interesting question. And I know in the rollout of respectful relationships in schools, part of the discussion is that it's not like you have a bullying program over here and then something around respectful relationships. It's all kind of joined up. But I don't know about that causal link.
What about the importance of positive male role models? I imagine some of these boys growing up in this kind of environment may just not see what right looks like anywhere. And there seems to be an underrepresentation of male primary school teachers.
Yeah.
You know, there's a potential that they're just not seeing good male humans as
yeah.
well. Is that something you're seeing?
I think that is a factor. To be honest, we don't have a lot of males working in the sector. I mean, I guess it's like the same thing for primary school
yeah.
teachers. It's not an area that attracts a lot of men. I know there are some mentoring programs that are being run by some services where men who don't use violence are mentoring young men. So definitely I think there is a role for it. I think it would be, it's probably an undeveloped thing in the whole sector. I think maybe one place where we're seeing it happening is in Aboriginal communities, that local community groups are more starting to look at the role of mentoring of young men, making sure young men connect more with culture and trying to use that as the, And for a range of things, not just domestic violence, but just around, you know, what it means to be a man. So that's probably an area I'm more aware of it happening. I know there's probably groups around like Steve Bidoff and those kind of groups as well. But I think more recently I've seen it more happening, like I said, amongst Aboriginal groups where they're bringing in elders much more and really trying to address some pretty critical you know, issues in their community, because of course there's the higher suicide rates as well as all those other issues.
Mm-hmm. For years I've always been fascinated, Leanne, on the question, who cares for the carers? And you've been a social worker involved in counselling your whole life, and no doubt most of your staff have as well. And I'm assuming that on a daily basis you are seeing things that are profoundly challenging to process.
Mm.
Perhaps even outright evil.
Mm.
How do you get through that?
Mm. Well, I mean, I haven't been a counsellor the whole time, but I have worked in the sector for about 30 years. And I think it is something I've really had to develop in myself. You know, and I guess there are times in your life where you're more vulnerable as well. So the last time I worked in refuges, my eldest daughter was 2 years old. And that was a time where I found the work really difficult. I felt very confronted by it. I'd hold the stories with me all the time, what was happening to the kids. And I think, you know, that's probably related to your own life stage. Mm. So because my daughter was young, it was like I was very open and probably more vulnerable at that stage in my life to, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know if I'm explaining it very well, but it's sort of my own time in life rather than anything different in the work.
Yeah, that particular chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which resonates. I mean, Tim, you obviously with the Rod Bridges episode, who lost a teenage son through drugs, with your own chapter in your life that resonated pretty.
Yeah. I mean, he lost his son at 16, mine 17.
It's
very, very close at the
moment.
Yeah.
There's just those touch points where you feel like life feels kind of vulnerable.
Mm.
And I guess for me, like I'm not someone who self-care comes to naturally. So I'm not a natural exerciser. Mm. I'm not a natural kind of,
You're a carer, not a carer.
Yeah, it's always something I've struggled with at different points over my career. You know, a few years ago, I started doing Tai Chi. And that has become one kind of linchpin that I've sort of held on to. So it's like the yoga might, you know, slip away, the swimming slips away, but I always do my Tai Chi. So I think, you know, the importance of those activities.
Mm.
And I guess the other thing is that, you know, it's like you kind of, you have to sort of be kind of tough inside and soft outside.
Mm.
So I feel like I don't ever lose the the sense around someone's story, that always touches me, but not in a way that I would kind of collapse around it. And I think part of it is, you know, we're paid to be in this space. This is the job. I chose it. So it's my responsibility to stay in the space where I can, you know, be strategic, think about what a solution is, how it's going to be fixed. Mm. Because if I go into the depths of the story, then I'm not able to do that anymore.
Mm.
So I think that's really something you kind of learn over time. I think probably everyone in their work history has a story that's really touched them or really felt like, oh, I just can't keep doing this. So, but it's around thinking about why are we here, and this, you know, like I said, this is what we choose to do.
Mm. I mean, our first careers obviously were in uniform, and we spent a fair bit of time in the SAS regiment, where it's difficult to explain life in the unit, but one of the simplest ways that I do explain it is there's incredibly shared and common purpose, which is actually the same inside your staff group.
Yeah.
There's shared and common purpose.
Yeah.
Can that staff group create a release valve? Are you able to internally your staff use that as a mechanism to share and overcome the challenges?
Yeah, we probably have quite a few processes. So staff have supervision. We have team meetings where, you know, what we're working on is discussed. We have regular all-staff meetings. We've recently gone back and looked at our values again, and that thing about, you know, what made you come here and then what makes you come back every day. So I guess trying to think about that, because ultimately we're like a values-driven organisation. I guess there's a bit of gallows humour that goes on, you know, which is about just surviving and kind of, I don't know, bumping against the work sort of thing.
And in many ways, from my experience, normalising these incredibly abnormal things that you're seeing. So a combat experience, the ability to share that with people who have lived that same experience and maybe make a bit of light of it, which out of context may sound insensitive, but that gallows humour comment you just made resonated.
Yeah, like we see things that lots of other people just don't know. They'd have no idea. So we've got that common language. You know, I'm not going to go home and talk about what I saw, the injuries I saw, you know, that kind of thing, or, you know, the terrible story. So they're held kind of within the team, which they should be because, you know, it's individual women's lives. It's not, you know, for other people's consumption or whatever. Yeah.
Now, speaking of these individual women, a common thread throughout our show is people doing amazing things. And we've spoken to people who have achieved incredible physical feats and mental resilience and achieved these amazing career milestones. And yet, when I imagine what some of these women are going through, just that day-to-day existence, the challenges that they're facing, the courage it takes to try and break out of that, and then the ability to piece their lives back together and keep putting one foot in front of another. I mean, that to me is resilience in a nutshell.
Yeah.
You must see some incredibly strong human beings.
Yeah, we do. And I think it's a really important point to focus on the resilience of those women. Rosie Batty described, you know, domestic violence as like terrorism in your own home. And for lots of the people we work with, you know, that's what it's like. They're walking on eggshells all the time. Particularly for women with kids, I think we see how protective they are towards the children, the kind of lengths that they go to keep their kids as safe as they possibly can. And I think we know, and a lot of women know, that the period immediately after a woman leaves is the most dangerous. I think it's like 70 times more likely to be killed or seriously injured by a partner after she leaves. So, you know, that's one of the things that keeps women in the relationship. And it is a very real fear. I just think when often by the time women come to the refuge, it's like, even though they've done this amazingly brave thing, it's like they don't quite kind of feel it.
Yeah.
And I guess it's our role to really support them in that kind of almost reinforce their bravery and remind them of all the things that they have done to manage their lives, because I think there's a lot of shame associated with domestic violence. It still is quite hidden in a lot of families. And that means that, you know, like I said, women lose sight of all that they've done to keep themselves as safe as they can, keep their kids as safe as they can.
And I imagine, I mean, these women and children are dictionary definition victims, and yet you don't want to instill victimhood in them as a thing that defines their lives,
yeah,
do you?
And that's right. And they are victims because it's a crime to assault someone, yeah, you know. So they're a victim in that sense. And then they're survivors,
yeah,
as well, yeah.
And you want to emphasise that resilience and survival,
yeah,
as the means forward.
Yeah.
You mentioned before that this is still a taboo. You don't hear enough about it. You don't hear much about it. Those statistics blew me away when I first read them. The outsider's perspective is that this tends to be confined to lower socioeconomic areas, that it tends to be confined to certain demographic groups, certain cultural backgrounds. Is that the case?
It's not the case. In terms of who seeks our services, it probably reflects that more because of not having a lot of options. I think Rosie Batty's experience showed that it can happen to anyone. And one of the things that we noticed after, you know, she had such a public profile was that we saw an increase in older women, often with professions, coming forward for our counselling programs. So they weren't necessarily seeking refuge accommodation, but they were coming forward saying, I've lived with this for years. So she almost kind of gave permission for those, yeah, women to come forward. And I think partly because we tend to associate it with a race, a class, that kind of thing. I think financial abuse really hits across all levels. And, you know, the more money you've got, the higher the stakes are. And that's something that we've been doing a lot of work on, is around financial abuse and helping women with their financial literacy. So, yeah, again, and financial abuse is, you know, it's part of that pattern of control. So it could exist all on its own, but chances are that there will also be physical violence and emotional violence. So, yeah, definitely that goes across the board.
So you just mentioned financial literacy. Can we talk a bit more about a couple of the other techniques that I know you use within STARIC? Can you tell us a little bit about mindfulness?
I guess that's something I try and practice myself. So I do a meditation every morning, just a 10-minute one. And it's something we do with staff as well. We have one of the Buddhist societies come in and do meditation with the women once a month on a voluntary basis. And I guess the importance of mindfulness for us and for the women is that we're in a crisis environment where things are moving really quickly, and then, you know, you're having emotional reactions to things as they happen. So it's about taking that time to just stop and, you know, reflect. We probably don't do it as much as we should. But definitely is a technique that we use, yeah. Yeah.
The reason I ask, and I find it very interesting, we've had a couple of guests speak about this, certainly something I don't do as much as I should. I think, Tim, you're a bit better with the mindfulness than I am, but I do think it's a very powerful mechanism to focus on the here and now and the things you can control and
yeah,
maybe try and disempower those things that you can't control in some cases.
Yeah.
Particularly in that environment where there's complete sensory overload, you're overwhelmed with things, just centering back on yourself and filtering them out. I think it's critical.
I think it's, I suppose I've been thinking about it more and more as I've embarked on my own mindfulness meditations. But the refuges, because it's almost like a big house, women have their separate living spaces, but you've got a whole group of people who are there all the time. And because women are coming in crisis, it's like the cortisol levels are really high in the space. And just recently I've thought, probably for staff, we don't think enough about what it feels like to work every day in that environment.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that air of crisis infects the whole service. So for me, I'm in the office. I'm not in any of the services. We've got a little admin office that's separate from everything. But yeah, somehow when we come to work, it's just, it feels like that sense of crisis infects you. And it's because when you come to work, you might have a plan, but something kicks off, you know, in the house or whatever. And then everything goes out the window.
Yep.
You know, you might have, we had to lock one of the refuges down a couple of weeks ago because a perpetrator thought that his ex-partner was there and she wasn't, but he was convinced that she was, and we knew he was very dangerous, access to weapons, all that sort of thing. So for 2 days, we were in this kind of lockdown situation. Mm. And I guess it's not always as extreme as that, but that's the kind of thing I mean. You just don't quite know what might happen.
That certainly sounds like a really confronting space to live in, and it brings these questions about what can we, from a justice perspective, do about this. I'd be interested in your relationship with police and where you view the current situation of the legal system is in regards to these repeat domestic violence offenders.
Mm-hmm. I think back, you know, to when I worked in refuges all that time ago, it was about 25 years ago. Definitely the relationship with police is much better. I think the relationship between refuges and police was often quite confrontational. And from refuges' point of view, we felt like police weren't taking the level of risk seriously enough for a lot of women. So, you know, it really has changed quite a bit to the extent where we've seen specialist domestic violence units within police stations, and understanding that domestic violence really is core police work now. It's not just one other thing or something, you know, that they have to do but they shouldn't really be doing. So that's a real shift. We've been in the police stations, I think, for 20 years. And so I think that reflects how, you know, good the relationship is. And I think, you know, we see more and more that what we provide that complements what the police do is that when the women first come in, you know, we're not uniformed. That's the first thing. We've got time to spend, whereas police can seem very busy and like they've got to get on with the next thing. So there's time for the woman to talk through her situations, and then we can liaise with the police. I think at times those joint visits where police and a non-government person or a, you know, an advocate goes out together, I think that's a really great service to help diffuse situations, but also let women know that they're supported when an incident has happened. I think for us, probably there are still times where there's a domestic violence order and the male breaches that. There might be multiple breaches, but it's only treated as one. So for us, that's a bit of an issue because the multiple breaches are really about continuing that kind of fear and intimidation. So that would that's one of the things which I think is a bit of an ongoing frustration for us.
It is dangerous to generalise, but are there preconditions that you can read that lead up to domestic violence? Drugs, alcohol, undereducation?
I think we say that domestic violence intersects with other things. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if there's drugs and alcohol, it's not causal, but it might exacerbate it or increase the level of violence that's used. I guess we kind of think about there might be warning signs when women first meet a new partner.
That's quite fascinating, some of those early warning signs, the little precursors. What sort of things are you seeing that may indicate a propensity to domestic violence?
I think there's a few what we call kind of red flags. So some of them are if there's in quite early in the relationship, there's like at first it might seem perfect, but if there's a kind of switching between compliments and criticism and they kind of go in quick succession, and they might be linked to kind of a withdrawal of attention. I think issues around money, if there's some controlling behaviour around money, those sorts of things. Suggestions that all your friends are no good, you know.
To try and isolate.
Yeah, them. So that's social isolation, criticism of your family, so that, no, don't go out, stay in. What do you have to see them for? Mm. Those kind of things we would see as just really early indicators that there's, you know, a pattern of control mm-hmm. For that person, you know, that they're exercising.
That's interesting. Leanne, tell us some happy stories. You must see people that go through this enormous hardship but just come out of this in a positive way.
You know, we've got a woman who used our service really only very briefly. Judith, her name is, and she sometimes speaks for us publicly. And she's a woman who left her relationship over 20 years ago. And she's now established herself as a vet. She's got a great vet practice. And also, yeah, she's happy to stand up and tell her story, what happened to her. I think she just really has that passion around not wanting other women to have the same experience, or if they do, to let women know that there's somewhere where they can get away to.
And I imagine, like your Rosie Batty example, to normalise it, destigmatise it, to give people permission to come forward and seek help.
I'm not sure if you saw You Can't Ask That the other night on the ABC, which was a series of domestic violence survivors, and they were asking them, why didn't you leave, that kind of thing. And I felt like their stories were really inspiring. I mean, I guess within our service we've got women who experienced domestic violence earlier on in their lives, and now they're in our service, they're really passionate advocates. They're really compassionate, and, you know, it's almost like they've dedicated their lives to working with survivors of domestic violence. I think we've got examples where kids have come into the refuge and been really withdrawn, having lots of nightmares, not wanting to go to school. And our child advocates have worked really closely with them, offered a bit of counselling or referral to counselling, worked on supporting them, different activities that we have around children's difficulties. And slowly we've seen those children blossom. And that's, you know, that's just a great moment. And I guess every individual worker would have their kind of stories that they hold on to, because, I mean, that's part of your survival mechanism
what
as well, to
go?
Remember, you know, the women who did well after they left the service.
Yeah.
We do have women come back afterwards, you know, a few years down the track and say, thank you, you know, so we do have those experiences.
Supplementary question. Leanne, how do you define happiness?
Me? Oh, okay. I think for me, it's probably around purpose. So that probably is a big driver for me. You've probably hit a weak spot now.
Well, actually, I think it speaks volumes on the fact that you focus so much on looking after other people. And outside of Tai Chi and some mindfulness, it's an interesting question to dwell on.
Yeah.
How do I define happiness?
Yeah.
Because that is the path, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right. Like, for me, I know it's purpose. I think probably maybe I'm at a point in my life where I am kind of thinking about what's that sort of bigger picture, because my kids are grown up now. So, it probably is something I need to think about more for myself.
That's our homework question for you.
Great.
But, Tim, you have spoken before about that idea of doing something for something bigger than just yourself as being incredibly important in your life as well.
I'm a believer that, you know, if we can do one more thing in our lives, do something that's bigger than you. I sit on the advisory board of Starlight Children's Foundation.
Oh,
I find that incredibly fulfilling.
Yeah.
And I take a lot of inspiration from that. And I think really importantly, we talk about this great word perspective. It brings perspective. You know, the first world problems are insignificant when you are a child or a parent of a child who is living in hospital. And there are many, many other examples, of course, of that and doing something bigger than you. But it sounds like that's consumed your life through years and years and years of social work.
And, well, you know, raising my girls as well. So, I mean, probably don't put this in the podcast, but I do.
Like that means we absolutely will be.
Like in the last few years, I've started writing. So I'm part of a songwriting group, go on sort of workshops, got a little ukulele. So I've kind of, it's like almost like there's time for those parts of yourself to get a bit bigger.
We found the destination for our theme song.
That is very cool hearing you say that. I was just having a chat with Phoebe outside, part of the wonderful studio staff here, about the importance of having a creative outlet and how it helps different parts of your brain. It's a meditative process. Yeah. I think it makes you better in your day job.
I think it, because it triggers that different part of your brain. So for me, often at the desk, a lot of my work is quite, even though the content is emotional, the practice is kind of rational. So since I've started writing, I find that, that side of my brain's just opened up. Like I scribble things, all, you know, I've got little bits of paper all over the place and I use it to process a lot of stuff. So and, you know, and I guess when I was younger, in my 20s, I was in a band. But then, of course, you have kids and it all kind of falls away. So it's time, you know, where that's opened up again.
There's a component of mindfulness in that, isn't it? Just focusing on writing a song and getting that right.
Do
you use art therapy, any form of art, however it's defined inside the programs?
Yeah, we do. So from time to time, we rely on volunteers for it. It's quite an expensive kind of practice. So every now and again, someone comes forward and does some art therapy for us. So, and I, the other things we have, so we do yoga and meditation for the women. And we've got a writing program called Lived Experience, and that's a therapeutic writing program for the women. So we use a writing coach and she works with groups of around five women, and they kind of they tell this, they write their story down first, and then she helps them work on their story, and then if they want to, they can go on and tell it publicly, and then we'll help them with public speaking skills. And I guess we think that program's so important because in domestic violence, women lose their voice because it's like a secret that they're keeping. They can't tell friends or family. They're scared to say what they think because of the consequences. So this gives them back that voice to kind of tell that story.
My my brother, who was an army doctor and suffered PTSD after some experiences in Afghanistan, part of his rehabilitation was doing exactly that, writing down his story. And he describes it as getting it out of his head and onto a page and very much codifying it and putting a bow around it in many, in many ways. It sounds obviously a very effective
Method. Yeah, yeah, it's great.
So what's the future? When will you rest?
When will I rest? Well, I was thinking in relation to the unforgiving 60 that what I need more is the forgiving 60.
Life's sadly not like that, and you well know it, Leanne.
I think I've got, in terms of my work, what I'm doing, I've probably got a few more things that I would like to achieve, and one of them is particularly around the service for children. I really feel like we need to somehow find some funding or something to get better, more therapeutic work happening with kids to help them heal and just give them the best chance. Like, they've come into our service because their mums have fled, and often they're with us in the refuges for, say, 3 months. Like, I feel like we do the best we can, but I really would like us to do better. And I'd also like the support for children to follow them after they leave the refuge. So one of the things that I often think about is that We all know from moving home that it's one of life's most, you know, stressful situations. So these children have fled their home, they've landed in a refuge, then they've moved to another home, one of, say maybe one of our transitional homes, and then in 12 to 24 months they move again. So there's multiple transitions, but not done in a plan choice kind of way. So I think that the support needs to more closely follow those children through that process. So that's my dream in terms of work. And I guess I do just, I've just got a thing about we need to reflect all the time on what we're doing. Is it working for the women we're working with? You know, that kind of, the are they achieving what they want as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course your professional ukulele career.
That's right. Well, surely it'll take off sometime. Probably the one place in the world where there really is a glass ceiling and I've hit up against it in terms of my talent.
Never say never. Two quick questions. What do you advise people who are suffering from domestic violence? What should they do?
I think the first thing is to tell a trusted person. Mm-hmm. And similarly, for the person who's going to be told, if someone discloses to you, I just urge people to please believe that person. One of the things that we know through our practice and through research as well is that the first time, the response someone gets the first time they disclose it pretty well determines what's going to happen next. So if someone discloses that it's happening to them and they're not believed or they get a negative reaction, it might be years before they tell anyone again. Mm-hmm. So, and that puts them obviously at more risk. There's helplines, crisis care, the domestic violence helpline. So they're places to start. If you're making those calls, make sure you're making them safely. And you know, contact a service, or if you don't feel like you're quite ready to, online you can look up things like safety plans, which talk about making yourself safe in the event that you need to leave. They would be the main things I'd say.
Thank you.
And I think I'd also say that if you're someone using violence and you're not happy, deep inside, you know it's not the right thing, I would say seek help as well.
And those same sort of avenues, the domestic violence helpline?
Yeah, there's the men's helpline. I think I would confide in a trusted friend, just say, you know, I'm not happy with what I'm doing, I feel uncomfortable. One of the things might just be in terms of how do the kids react when, you use those behaviours. So think about that and reach out. Yeah.
Magic. And we'll include those numbers in our show notes.
Okay, great.
That'll accompany the podcast. And the final question, if people want to learn more about Starrick or contribute to help you, how could they do that?
Go on our website. Mm-hmm. We've got some fundraising coming up. So we've got a high tea the day before Mother's Day. And that's one of our major fundraising events for the year. We use the fundraising to provide those add-on programs like lived experience. I forgot to mention that we do baby massage. So we fund that out of fundraised funds.
Donations,
as well.
Yep.
There's a donations portal if people feel like they want to make a cash donation. And also we have a Friends of Starrick newsletter that people can sign up to, which just talks about the different things that we're up to. A few avenues.
Leanne, thank you. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak about this. It's certainly been an eye-opener for me. Like I said, I had no idea the level of a problem that this is in the Australian society, and I'm sure it's mirrored in many countries around the world. We really appreciate you shining a bit of light on this.
Thank you. Thank you for your questions too. Thanks.
Thank you.
That was awesome. Thanks. Definitely getting the ukulele bit. Not negotiable.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.